You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.
Welcome to Spycast, the official podcast of the International Spy Museum. I'm your host, Dr. Andrew Hammond, the museum's historian and curator. Coming up next on Spycast.
But it was also became known as the works canteen of the intelligence community, because everybody used to either go into our bar or into the restaurant or the lobby to meet people, but it was mostly in the bar. And that's where Burgess, McLean and Philby, at different times, met their Russian handlers in plain sight and sat there and spoke, you know, normally didn't talk out the side of their mouths and have red carnations and copies of the Financial Times under their arm. They just all passed over their information, their paperwork or whatever, in plain sight to everybody.
Stephen Duffy is the night security manager at the St. Ermin's Hotel, Westminster, London, which, if you're unfamiliar with London, is right at the very heart of the British power structure, with the Houses of Parliament on one side and Buckingham Palace on the other, and with MI5 and MI6 just a little further down the River Thames. Stephen is also the custodian of the history of this legendary spy hotel, where the origin of the Special Operations Executive was quite literally drawn up on the back of a menu card, which is now deposited in the UK National Archives. In this episode, we discuss the origins of the SOE, MI6 and the SOE in the hotel during World War II, spoiler alert, bad neighbours, incredible female spies of the World War II, St. Ermin's Cambridge 5 connection, and the broader history of the hotel, which goes way back when. If you enjoy the show, please tell your friends and loved ones and consider leaving us a 5-star review. The original podcast on intelligence since 2006, we are Spycast. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. Tell us a little bit more about the St. Ermin's Hotel. We're going to explore its relationship to the history of espionage and intelligence, but let's just help our listeners understand, where is it? How long has it been there? You know, where is it in London? And then we'll move on to the other stuff next.
Okay. Well, St. Ermin's Hotel is based in Westminster. It is a 200-year-old hotel, a 200-year-old building. The building was originally built as an apartment block, and the original owner kept it as an apartment block for about 25 years before realizing that he could make a few more, you know, as we say in London, a few more quid by turning it into a private hotel. So for the last 175 years, it's been a private hotel. It does have an extensive history. We are within walking distance, within Parliament, Westminster Abbey, Buckingham Palace. And so, you know, we're right in the middle of it. And particularly the coronation, we're going to have a front row seat on that as well.
In Westminster, for listeners that aren't familiar with London, that's where the Houses of Parliament and so forth are. It's right in the heart of London.
Yeah, it's the centre. Westminster is the largest. London is made up of two cities and 33 boroughs. London is the City of Westminster, the City of London, which is the financial district, and then the 33 boroughs that surround London. But Westminster is where the heart of government and state and power are, basically.
And can you just tell listeners a little bit more about how you came to do what you're doing? So tell them about your day job and then tell them briefly about how you came to be the custodian of some of the stories of the St. Ermin's Hotel.
My day job is I'm a part of the safety and security team, and I work on also work on a night team. So I predominantly work at night, looking after the hotel. And during lockdown, between March 2020 and May 2021, the hotel was closed completely. So we couldn't leave it entirely, just close the doors and walk away. We were part of a skeleton crew, or should I say, I was part of a skeleton crew looking after it. And that during that time, because the hotel was empty, we were there. We had plenty of time to do the research. I'm a great fan of history, military history, and it was great to be able to dig deeper into the history of the hotel. And from that, I was able to come up with the ideas for the guided tour around the hotel and to entertain the guests.
And has there been any talk about you coming off of your regular duties to just be a full-time curator and historian of these stories?
I think that's an ongoing discussion, because I've been doing the tours now for about a year, 13 months now or so. And so it's gradually developing, and the word is spreading, as it were. But obviously, I'm hoping that as we expand our exhibits and our little showcases that we have in the hotel, hopefully the bosses will think that's a good idea and have me doing it full time.
Mm. I was going to say, for our listeners, if any of them ever go to the hotel or go to Westminster, there's a great place, one of my favourite places in London, for food, the Regency Cafe, where you can get an awesome full English breakfast. I'm sure you've been there a few times, Stephen.
Yes, yeah, it's a regular haunt of mine. After my I usually finish my night shifts on a Monday morning, so wherever possible, I'm at least once or twice a month, I'm always at the Regency Cafe, filling up after a very busy night.
And the tea is so strong that you could feel a U2.
Builder's tea. Yeah, that's right.
Builder's tea. So let's dig into a little bit more about the history of the hotel. So tell us about how it first intersects with the world of intelligence and espionage. Now, obviously, because of its location, it probably will have, even before, things were formalized or were captured in documents. But when, for you, is the beginning of this story between the hotel and espionage and intelligence?
I think it would actually, from looking at the records and looking at the archives, it goes back to when the actual apartment block was built. Around that period, because even today, when you have apartment blocks and fancy developments being built, investors are asked to do that. Well, one of the investors for St. Ermin's was Kaiser Wilhelm II, German. Who happened to be the German ambassador, or part of a German delegation that was in London at the time. So we're talking around about the sort of the late 1800s, early 1900s, and he was there and was seen to have was almost playing Monopoly, if you like, was playing Monopoly around London with various properties and various apartment blocks and buildings and things like that. But he was the watch of intelligence services, shall we say, as they were at the time. They were keeping an eye on him because they realised, why is he investing all this money in our London? What's going on? Is he trying to take over? Are the Germans trying to do something? That sort of thing. So that was an earlier reference there to it.
This was just before World War One.
Yes, just before. Before World War One. Yeah.
And there's a big anti-German skate around then. There's German spies everywhere. There's paranoia, right?
Yeah, up in every tree and every bush, there was a German, German spy hanging around. The guy in the coat and the trilby hat was a German spy. Was the time, and so there was a lot of that sort of going anti feeling going on. But it's itself, the hotel had always been involved with intelligence service because it was the hotel's very discreet. Because of its location, where we are off Victoria Street in Westminster, because we're off there at a set aside, it's almost hiding in plain sight, if you like. for want of a better word, where a lot of organisations and perhaps even so today, who knows, are using the hotel as, you know, as cover for something else.
And it's not too far away from the current homes of MI5 and MI6. Where is the hotel in relation to their former homes for our listeners?
Now, the former homes, so you have MI5 and MI6 there. Talk about the early days. You had just around the corner on Broadway, the street on Broadway, this Broadway House is there, which is one of the buildings that they used. But also we have another building that, which is no longer there, which is also on Westminster. Just literally we're, you know, surrounds us. They surround us. But GCHQ used to have a premises next, virtually next door to us. But they moved, they've since moved now into a newer premises in Victoria Street.
When GCHQ were there, was this early in the 20th century when there were the government code and cipher school?
Yes, they've well, the premises that they had there, I believe that they were there from post-Second World War, so from the sort of late 40s upwards until just recently. So I would say probably about 2017, I would say they moved maybe, they certainly moved everybody out of the building.
Wow. And I know that Churchill was a visitor there. Can you tell us a little bit more about Hold Your Powder for the Second World War period? Just tell us about Churchill. Did he come to the hotel before the war? I know that it became one of his regular haunts, but when does he first become part of the story of the hotel?
So Winston Churchill became part of the hotel, or part of the story of the hotel, in 1926. The next door, immediately next door to us, was Caxton Hall, which was at the time the Westminster Town Hall, and then became the registry office for births, deaths and marriages, people getting married and things like that. But at that time, they had a public meeting hall there. A section of it was a public meeting hall. Sir Winston Churchill held an election rally there. He was running for election for Parliament. I think it may have been to the Liberal Party. He was running there and had a meeting there. We're not sure whether he was. He came into the bar, came into the hotel to celebrate or commiserate. But ever since then, he was associated, ever since that night, he came in to drink his favourite champagne in the bar. And ever since then, he was associated with the hotel up until his death in 1965.
Wow. And for the First World War, did the intelligence story get fleshed out during this period? So you mentioned Kaiser Wilhelm II. During the war itself, was the hotel part of this hotbed of espionage and intelligence around London?
Well, it was and it wasn't, because the British government moves in mysterious ways. But unfortunately, what they did is they decided, oh, the hotel would be ideal as a hospital. So they commandeered the hospital, the hotel, and turned it into a hospital. The British Army took it over for the duration of the First World War and built temporary structures in there. So you had army nurses and doctors, Catholic nursing nuns in there looking after the place. And they were looking after recovering soldiers who'd been fighting on the Western Front in France and Belgium. And the thing was, is that was going on, but also at the same time, there was also a small intelligence detachment because they were trying to find out information and trying to find out, you know, have a base there to see if they would find out any information, whether the injured servicemen were bringing back information, or whether there was, you know, anything of use to them.
Wow. And how many rooms does the hotel have, Steve?
It has 331, currently has 331 rooms, and 15 meeting rooms and a restaurant and a bar as well. The building, as I say, is the 200 years old. So there's it's a listed building, so it's very difficult to fit those in. But what we have done is fitted in 331 rooms there. So it's about 900 people we could house there overnight.
And it's a luxury hotel, right?
Yes, it is. It's we're a four-star deluxe hotel. We don't have a pool and we don't have a sauna because of the size and shape of the building. There's nowhere to put them, unfortunately. And it's age of the building. There's nowhere to put them.
So it's one of these hotels that you go for the character more than for sitting in
absolutely.
The hot tub after the bar. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sounds like my kind of hotel. So let's walk the story up to the Second World War then. So help us understand, you know, before the war begins, you know, Churchill's on the back benches, you know, talking about rearmament and so forth. And part of the intelligence game of the war is happening before the war actually erupts. So help us understand the hotel and the lead up to the conflagration that is the Second World War.
There had been a number of, going through the records, there had been a number of meetings where, as I say, Sir Winston Churchill had been associated with the hotel since 1926. So that was his regular place to hold court, if it were, outside of Parliament. So he would talk to journalists, he would talk to other MPs, other ministers or other interested parties in the lobby of the hotel or in the bar of the hotel. He would hold court there, have meetings, dinners, events and things like that. So it was building up to his, shall we say, his election as Prime Minister in the May of 1940. So we could probably say we had our front seat, if you like, of watching what was the developments of the build-up to the start of the war, and then once the war had started, to see how it was going. But obviously, even by the time Sir Winston Churchill was elected in May 1940, the war wasn't going very, very well. So they needed something to take that fight back to the enemy.
And this is where we lead up to the one of the big claims to fame for the hotel. And just before we get to that point, what does St. Ermin's mean? Is there, you know, is there a story there, or is it one of these things that we know that that's what it's called, but we've kind of lost why it was called that?
Well, no, it's actually called St. Ermin's because it goes way back to the time before before Henry VIII, and also to goes back in history where you've got there was actually a monk called St. Ermin's, or there was Ermin, and he was made a saint. He actually was leading sort of the charge for Christianity in the pagan world at that time.
I was just wondering, during the war, does the hotel get damaged at all during the Blitz?
No, not at all. Surprisingly, that's the one thing that I found very surprising, given the amount of bombing that the Luftwaffe did in the area around Westminster and the targets, Palace of Westminster, Buckingham Palace, Westminster Abbey, and all the other sort of targets in that sort of area, if you like. The hotel itself survived, but all the buildings around it, except for one, the Caxton Hall next door, the building opposite and to the side, were all destroyed.
Let's do the big reveal now. Tell our listeners why it would have been advantageous for the Germans to bomb the St. Ermin's Hotel during World War II.
Just in May 1940, Sir Winston Churchill was elected as Prime Minister. And as I referred to briefly just now, he needed something. The war wasn't going very, very well, and he needed something to take the fight back to the enemy. So he had called in the June of 1940, he got his ministers, intelligence chiefs, military chiefs, everybody together for a dinner at St. Ermin's. And about 15, 20 people, they got together, they sat down and had a dinner. And during the course of the dinner, they discussed how to take the fight back to the Germans. And it was during this that Sir Winston had remembered his time in the Boer War, fighting, reporting and fighting on in fighting in the Boer War. He himself was captured by the Boer commandos in the Boer War and held in what was a prisoner of war camp. He then realized he could use their style that they used of undercover people in undercover agents, if you like, going into certain areas, disrupting what the enemy was doing. In that case, it was the British Army. But in this case, it was going to be the Germans. So they came up with an organization called the Special Operations Executive, which was formed there at that dinner. And within 6 weeks of that dinner, the SOE, or Special Operations Executive, was up and running and up on the sixth floor of the St. Ermin's building. They had, you know, were told, right, get on with it, you know, action this day and everything like that.
And the sixth floor, that would be the headquarters of the SOE throughout the war?
Yes, for the first part, until they started to expand and to get bigger. And then they gradually moved from our building at St. Ermin's over around the corner to Broadway House, which I mentioned earlier. Broadway House, they had their base in there. And then they have a number of other locations around London as well, because they gradually started to get bigger and bigger with more people and more space. But our initial section there was F section, which was the French section, which was there in our building there. And that was the very first one to get everybody up and running and to start the training schools and various other things.
It's quite interesting, the timing of this, because the Dunkirk evacuation's happening at the end of May and going into the beginning of June. And it's during this period that you're saying when Churchill takes over the reins of office, becomes a prime minister, and then not long after Dunkirk, basically this idea to fight back to them is orchestrated. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. Women were recruited as well, because women felt that they could actually blend in and almost, as it were, disappear in any environment, because nobody would give a female a second look, if it's so to speak. They wouldn't give them a second look. Whereas if you'd see somebody, a man, they would expect him to be the spy. You wouldn't expect her to be the spy. That was the sort of USP, if you like, of it. It's using the females to get in there because they could blend in anyway.
Many of our listeners will have heard of the SOE, but for anybody that hasn't, could you just give them just a couple of sentences? What was the purpose of the SOE?
Yeah, the SOE was clandestine. It was a clandestine organisation, and it was basically to go in and disrupt everything and to disrupt whatever the Germans were doing. But their main job was to go in to occupy France, Belgium and Holland, and to coordinate with the French resistance, the Belgian resistance and the Holland Dutch resistance groups that were already on the ground fighting in their own countries, to coordinate all those efforts, to those groups together, and then as a united front to then start doing operations to disrupt the Germans, blowing up train lines, factories, anything to disrupt the supply chain for the Germans and just cause as much havoc as possible.
And this can go all the way from organization and logistics through to sabotage and blowing things up, as you say.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I mean, it was a case of initially getting everything coordinated, because the groups, the French resistance, the Marquis, and the various other groups didn't necessarily want to talk to each other. From, say, an area like Normandy or Paris, there's the different districts of Paris. They'd all have different groups. They weren't all communicating or talking to each other. So they're all running off doing their own little individual jobs. Whereas when the SOE came in and they coordinated them all, they were in a better position to do better targeted raids. And missions, if you like.
Who became head of the SOE during this period?
You had Colin Gubbins, who was the first of the head, but the head of the F section was Maurice Buckmaster. Maurice Buckmaster, who was the boss there of the group, the F section. So there was various different sections, but F for French section, for everybody that operated in France, because that was the closest one, and that's the one that's most associated with us, with our hotel. But Maurice Buckmaster was the boss, and then you had Vera Atkins, who was his, if you like, money penny for the of running all these back office.
Mm. She was pretty incredible. Who did these people report to? What was like the, we don't need to get too into the weeds on this, but what was the chain of command? Was there some line that went straight to the Prime Minister, or were they part of the military apparatus? Did they have to go up to Allenbrook, the chiefs of the Imperial staff and so forth? Or, yeah, help me understand how they related to the regular army.
Yeah, they were actually part of this, so they were clandestine organisations, so they technically didn't exist, although they were secret organisation. But the person who held the most sort of sway, the Buckmaster, then referred directly to the Prime Minister. So it went straight through to the Prime Minister's office for everything there. There was a chain of command for supplies and logistics organised. So within the War Office, there was the usual bureaucracy and everything else that had to be done through there. From that side of it, but anything for decisions or power, chain of command is the would have gone straight to sort of Downing Street to the Prime Minister.
To help you digest the episode, here's a quick primer on British wartime intelligence. The SOE was a secret, irregular warfare organisation whose primary goals were sabotage and subversion behind enemy lines, although it also engaged in espionage and reconnaissance. It was born of World War II and disbanded after World War II's end. World War II, MI5 and MI6 are both descended from the Secret Service Bureau, which was set up in 1909 to keep an eye on the rise of German military power and its challenge to British naval supremacy. There was a home section, MI5, and a foreign section, MI6. If you ever struggle to remember which is which, remember that the lower number is closer to home from the British perspective, MI5, whereas the higher number is further away, i.e. international, MI6. They are better known today, respectively, as the Security Service and the Secret Intelligence Service. MI5 and MI6, as titles, are technically archaic, since after their early years, they have been civilian agencies closer to civil servants than the military. Two qualifications worth bearing in mind. One, from the present-day vantage point, MI5's remit seems relatively circumscribed, i.e. its home is the British Isles. But remember that until after World War II, home was to some extent international because of the Empire and the Commonwealth. Two, because of our globalising world, the boundaries between the original home and foreign intelligence gathering distinction will continue to be less than crystal clear. Next, we also have MI9, which was another born of the war and disbanded upon its end. It was formed to facilitate the escape of Allied prisoners of war who had been captured and to help those who had been shot down to escape before they were captured. We can't discuss every organisation, every MI, but I think ending with the Government Code and Cipher School is a good way to round out this interlude. This was a signals intelligence organisation that had existed since 1919. It would become famous because of World War II, for its wartime headquarters, Bletchley Park, was where code breakers helped crack the German Enigma machine and other important codes. Alan Turing is probably the most famous cryptographer who worked here, partly because of the Benedict Cumberbatch movie, The Imitation Game. We'll be right back after this.
The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business. Don't struggle to align your organization's cybersecurity with business risk. Get the only solution that goes beyond reacting to threats with vulnerability and risk monitoring. You need the next evolution of MDR, and only Critical Start delivers it. Critical Start doesn't just monitor and respond to threats. They put you in control by detecting suspicious activities, quickly responding to contain threats, and identifying your most critical assets and protecting them against vulnerabilities and exposures. With continuous visibility, expert guidance, and measurable risk reduction, Critical Start has redefined what it means to manage cyber risk. Demonstrate provable security maturity to your leadership while positioning your program to achieve the greatest risk reduction per dollar spent. Stop fearing risk and start managing it with Critical Start. Visit CriticalStart.com and request a demo today. That's CriticalStart.com.
Can you tell our listeners some of the other interesting occupants of the hotel during the Second World War?
Yes. I mean, we've also had, during that time, we also had, when SOE set up their first office there on the sixth floor, In the corridor, they had a suite of rooms on one side of the corridor. On the opposite side of the corridor was MI6. MI6, or Secret Intelligence Service, they were actually on the opposite side of them. And as you can imagine, the MI6 did not like the SOE because they were seen as these Johnny-come-lately, who are these young upstarts that are here? Who are these jokers? And so it did take a little while for them to try and work together. Particularly because SOE, when it first started, did not have its own communications network, its own wireless or radio network, and had to rely on messages being passed by MI6 across the corridor. And being the old-school Etonians or, Cambridge or whatever they were, public school guys, the MI6 would often sit on those messages for a couple of days and pretend they'd lost them, whereas SOE is having to try and sort of rely on them for the messages, but they then eventually got their own wireless network.
So when you say MI6, Steve, do you mean that the whole of MI6 was based there, or was that an overgrowth? Was that a particular outpost of MI6, or
it's just an outpost? It wasn't the whole group. I mean, obviously they were off doing other things, but this was a particular, a detachment, of them that were there in that office where they had their communication space set up, and so they had people out in the field doing whatever they were doing at the time. And so that's why SOE needed them, because they had this far-ranging wireless set that could, get them out to where their people are.
And what was the purpose of the outpost? Did they have a specific function, like the French unit? Help me understand what it was.
It has been difficult to find out, actually. It's not very well documented to say exactly what they were doing, but it's just that they were all based there together. It's believed that the MI6 group there could very well have been a French section, because that was the most dominant area that everybody was working in at that time before it expanded to the other areas.
And was that happenstance that MI6 and SOE were on opposite sides of the corridor, or was that intentional?
From what I could gather, I think it was just pure random luck that they just happened to be put together. I mean, I haven't seen anything to sort of say, okay, you're going to be billeted there and they're going to be billeted there, because I think MI6 were there first. And so it's just that because the great speed at which SOE was set up, I think that they needed every available space that they could find. So the SOE was sort of said, right, okay, the hotel said, that's the available space we've got, everybody in there. And it just so happens it was next door, opposite to MI6.
And for the genesis of the SOE, tell us the story of the menu card and how it came about, and if you still have the menu card, and then also the dinner. Set the scene for us.
Okay, if you imagine, it's June 1940, and as I say, Sir Winston Churchill has been Prime Minister for a month, and he is trying to find ways of taking the fight back to the enemy. He has called the dinner at St. Omens, and he has brought together all his military chiefs. So it includes Earl Mountbatten, and staff officer was Ian Fleming, both working in naval intelligence, or naval counterintelligence, should I say. And they, together with all the heads of the army, the Navy and the Air Force, the various intelligence, MI5, MI6, and a few other ministers and people like that. So about 20 people altogether that were all sat round at the dinner. The dinner went on, but as they were talking, Sir Winston had remembered about his time in the Boer War, as I mentioned earlier. But it was obviously as they toyed around with different ideas and they tossed around different ideas, as they're doing so, Sir Winston has a menu card. And on the back of the menu card, he's written down exactly what he wanted to do about the SOE, the clandestine undercover unit that he would send in to occupy France. And he even notated, if that's the right word, or made notes about how it would actually be done. So the two different things they would be the couriers and then the wireless operators. They would be the two roles, if you like, for both men and women that would be sent into the occupied areas to forward that, forward the cause, to develop the cause and coordinate the resistance groups. And that's what he saw Winston Churchill felt was the most important thing that they would do. And that was agreed on that night. And then, as I say, within 6 weeks, SOE, as we know it, was up and running.
And how do we know about the record card?
It is in the National Archive because it was held on to by the Churchill family. And it is, as I understand it, in the National Archive at Kew. There in West London. It's held in there. And it has to be viewed by arrangement. Oh, excuse me.
And tell us a little bit more about Hugh Dalton. He's quite a fascinating figure, the Minister for Economic Warfare.
Indeed, yes. Now, he was actually one of the ministers that was there for economic warfare, as you say. But he was brought into the, he was at the dinner as well. He was one of the ministers that was there at the dinner. And he had been given, officially given the task of told, right, let's go. I mean, the phrase, let's set Europe ablaze, let's get on with it, action this day, and all those sort of regular phrases from Sir Winston. But it was a case of he was the man that was has been officially associated with setting up the logistics or the skeleton, if you like, of SOE. And then everybody else was coming in and filling out the bones, putting flesh on the bones, if that's a word.
I think it may be quite interesting to give our listeners just a pen portrait of Vera Atkins, because I think she has a really fascinating role. And, you know, we can talk about this stuff abstractly, but it's always easier if you have examples of real people that were actually doing this kind of stuff. So let's just talk about her for a couple of minutes. Can you just give our listeners a primer on her?
Yeah, sure. Vera Atkins was a Romanian Jew that had worked in worked in Eastern Europe, and then had come over to London to work with the intelligence services in London. She had come to the attention of Maurice Buckmaster, because at the right time, I think it was just the right time for her to arrive in London, where she was going to be associated, going to be working with one particular ministry or one particular thing to do translation and various other work like that. But she came to the attention of Maurice Buckmaster, who then recruited her for SOE to be his back office. And Vera Atkins' job was basically to run that office with him, but also to recruit all the female agents that subsequently would be there. So to recruit, meet, interview, vet all the female agents. And she would then subsequently be apart from her main job of the back office running the operational side of it, she would then also have a regular view of all the female agents that were there, even to the extent that when they were going off on their missions from RAF Thamesford, flying off to France or to wherever it may be, she would actually see them off. She would make sure all their clothes that they were wearing were French. There was nothing British about them, nothing foreign. It was always, for the country that they were going to, and she'd make sure, and then she'd see and meet them when they came back again.
As a Spycast community, we've been getting our heads around artificial intelligence, the metaverse, and other emerging technologies and landscapes that have the capacity to disrupt the field of intelligence. In this show, we look at the present and future of intelligence and espionage, but as in this episode, also, and importantly, we look at the past of intelligence and espionage. How about then mixing past and future? Here are the top 5 books recommended by ChatGPT, the generative AI platform on the Special Operations Executive. Bear in mind that many of the SOE files have been lost to history due to fires, accidents, and bureaucratic banditry. 1. The Secret History of SOE, Special Operations Executive 1940-1945 by William Mackenzie. 2. Churchill's Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, The Mavericks Who Plotted Hitler's Defeat by Giles Milton. 3. The Women Who Lived for Danger, The Agents of the Special Operations Executive by Marcus Binney. 4. The Spy Who Loved, The Secrets and Lives of Christine Granville by Claire Mulley. 5. A Life in Secrets, Vera Atkins and the Missing Agents of World War II by Sarah Hill. I have to say, I'm actually pretty impressed. I am so glad I am not a history professor anymore, though, because if you're an academic, ChatGPT
must be a darn menace. It must also run the risk of massive grade inflation. I used to wish some of my students could come up with books like these five in their threadbare bibliographies.
Hey everybody, today I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show.
Let's just talk about another couple of the figures that are associated with the hotel. So I believe there's links to the Cambridge Five at the hotel. Can you speak about them?
Indeed. As soon as the European Theatre of War finished, the SOE, as it were, was disbanded, and the agents who'd been working for SOE were then swallowed up by MI6, recruited by MI6. So what wasn't known at the time was Burgess, Philby and MacLean were actually double agents for Russia. They had already been recruited or turned or whatever the case may be when they were at Cambridge. They'd already been recruited there, so they were already agents, if you like. And one of the things that they did is they used to meet quite a lot in the bar, because our hotel was not only the first base of the SOE, but it was also became known as the works canteen of the intelligence community. Because everybody used to either go into our bar or into the restaurant or the lobby to meet people, but it was mostly in the bar, and that's where Burgess, MacLean and Philby at different times met their Russian handlers in plain sight and sat there and spoke, you know, normally didn't talk out the side of their mouths and didn't have red carnations and copies of the Financial Times under their arm. They just all passed over their information, their paperwork or whatever, in plain sight to everybody.
And tell us a little bit more about that bar. That was the Caxton Bar.
That's right. That's the hotel's Caxton Bar. And that's our sort of famous bar, which for the last, as I say, at least for the last 175 years, has been the place where everybody would go to. And is, I think, a lot more people today, because a lot more things are becoming known, hopefully through my work, are becoming known about the hotel. There are actually people coming in of interest. They go to the bar because, hey, that's famous. That's where the spies meet.
And I'm imagining it does quite a good martini.
Oh, yes, very much so, yes. And also there is a drink there which is called a Vespa Lind.
Ah, Ian Fleming.
Yes, Ian Fleming, of course. Perhaps for your audience, I should explain that obviously at that meeting we spoke about, Ian Fleming, and he obviously went on to create this series of books about a character called James Bond. And we know, we understand that a number of the characters that were appearing there, Q, Moneypenny, and a couple of other characters, Vespa Lind was one in the books there, were all the inspiration for those characters came from SOE agents.
Erin, who works on the podcast with me, she had a look at the cocktail menu, and there's actually five drinks named after the Cambridge Five.
Yes, yes, there is, yeah.
And it's their code names, like Stanley for Philby and so forth.
Yeah, and you've got the difference, and they're in they're also different strengths as well, so they almost, you could sort of say that, but depending on which one you go for, packs more of a punch.
Okay. And just briefly, Violet Szabo, I think her story is really interesting. Can you tell us a little bit more about her?
Yes, the short version is that Violet Szabo was a young lady from South London who left school at 14. She went to work for a department store in Brixton in South London, During that, this was during the Second World War, she met, fell in love, and married a Foreign Legion officer by the name of Etienne Szabo. So Violette became Mrs. Szabo. They settled into married life in South London. They had a daughter called Tanya, and then Etienne went back off to fight with the Foreign Legion in North Africa, where sadly he was killed. Violette lost the soul of her life and her soulmate, and she had to decided to take the fight back to the Germans herself. She was so enraged by it and was recruited by the SOE. She's recruited by the SOE, particularly as she spoke fluent French. She had a French mother and a British father. She spoke fluent French without an accent, and so was recruited by SOE for her skills, put through her training, went on the first training course, on the first training mission, and was quite successful. When she came back from that, it was the night before D-Day, so the 5th of June 1944, and they needed a lot of SOE agents to go into Normandy to start disrupting the Germans before, when Operation Overlord was about to happen, to stop them being able to fight back. She was parachuted in there. She landed with six other SOE agents. They were picked up. They met. They were met in a truck by the French resistance, and they travelled down a road. They came towards a German roadblock. They turned the truck around. The Germans fired upon them, chased them, and then they went to a farmhouse nearby where Violette Szabo went up into a window on the first floor with a machine gun, actually held off the Germans for 4 hours with the machine gun so the others could escape. Obviously, she ran out of ammunition. The house was stormed. She was arrested, interrogated rather brutally by the Gestapo, and then went from prison to prison, and then sadly finally ended up at Ravensbrück concentration camp, where she was executed at the age of 23. And for that, she received the George Medal and the Croix de Guerre and the Légion d'Honneur.
Really incredible woman. Is the Cold War spy game part of the St. Herman's Hotel story as well, or does it end at the end of the Second World War?
Oh, no, it continues. No, it continues the Cold War. It continues with that, where, as you say, with Mr. Burgess, Philby and MacLean, that came out. And then even up as far as, I would say, the Iraq War. So, I mean, we still have connections there with the intelligence service. And even today, there's still things that are done there, you know, with the intelligence services still using the hotel for various different things, shall we say.
And I know that at the hotel there, you've got a small exhibit and you've got some artifacts and so forth. I would love to just educate our listeners a little bit more about them. Can they see them if they go to visit the hotel? And
yes,
what can
course,
they expect?
Yeah.
What can they expect to find? Give us a couple of highlights.
It's the showcase, the window there is the showcase. We're working with the London Clandestine Warfare Collection, who runs the collection. And as we're the birthplace of the SOE, they have put this first showcase there, and then they've got other showcases in other locations associated with the SOE. But in there, you will see Violette Szabo's uniform. When she was on the training, they needed a cover unit, so the First Aid Nursing Yeomanry, or the Women's Auxiliary Air Force with the female cover units. And Violette's First Aid Nursing Yeomanry uniform is in our showcase, as is the a thing called a well rod, which is a WELROD, a well rod, which is the world's first silenced pistol. And it's still being used by special forces today. We've got that. We've got also a biscuit tin radio, which is a wireless, shortwave wireless, a Morse code set that is packed and hidden into a biscuit tin, and then used by the agents, and then hidden in the biscuit tin and hidden in the cellar out of plain sight, you know, so nobody could find it.
How many tours are you giving every week, Steve?
Every week is not so much every week. I'm not doing at the moment. I usually do about three or four, but at the moment we're not quite into spring and summer yet. So as soon as it's spring and summer, then I'll be doing more. It's more popular then. But at the moment, they're a couple of times a month at the moment, but then they will get more as we go into spring and summer.
And how does one go on the tour? Do you have to be a guest of the hotel and then sign up for it? Or
No, what you can do is I have a lot of groups from outside, from both military, from the law enforcement, from government. They get in contact with me, they can email me, and we can arrange a date and a time. And we either do an afternoon version, which includes afternoon tea, or there's an evening version, which includes beer, beer and fish and chips. Afterwards, the tour and then the beer and fish and chips, obviously.
Yeah. We would love to come one day and take the tour and obviously have the fish and chips.
Yeah.
She's getting really excited just out of the corner of my. But both of us would love to come and see the hotel. It sounds fascinating. And just out of interest, do you know if there's any counterpart hotels in other parts of the world that have this, obviously not this unique story, but that are known as spy hotels? Maybe one in New York, Washington, Moscow, or Paris, or something?
I mean, I'm glad you asked me that question, because it's something that I was thinking about myself only just the other day about doing some research on. And I know somebody, one of the people that came on a tour, guests from America came on a tour, said he was sure there was one in DC. If not DC, then certainly in Virginia, somewhere in Virginia, that might be associated with the CIA or, you know, spy hotel, that type of thing. But again, it's something I need to do some research on and find out. But I'd be certainly willing to, happy to hear from anybody who is.
Since I'm in the United States and a lot of our listeners are from the United States, can you just tell our listeners if the OSS were part of the story of St. Ermin's Hotel?
Oh, yes, they were. Yes, indeed. Now, the Eisenhower, who was the commander of Allied forces in the UK at the time of the D-Day landings, and at the time of the SOE was being set up, he went to see the training school, the combat school in Scotland, the Airdrie in Scotland, and met William Fairburn and Eric Seitz, the chief instructors. And he liked what he saw and actually thought that this would actually, he wanted to get Sykes and Fairburn over to America to teach instructors in America how to do the same thing. So you'd have an American unit. So that is where the OSS was born, the Office of Strategic Services, which is now, as we know, the forerunner of the CIA.
So the St. Ermin's Hotel is basically the birthplace of the CIA?
Yes, it is. It is, actually. Yes, okay. We could say that. Yes, thank you very much.
Okay. Well, this has been so much fun. Thanks so much. And I'm really glad we made this happen in the end.
Yeah, me too.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Spycast. Please follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you go to our page at thecyberwire.com/podcasts/spycast, you can find links to further resources, detailed show notes, and full transcripts. Coming up on next week's show.
Sometimes people think there's this impervious wall between fact and fiction in intelligence, and that's simply not true. We know that intelligence officers read spy novels and go and see, you know, TV shows about spies and movies, perhaps more than most people, because they're interested in that topic.
If you have any feedback, you can reach us by email at spycast@spymuseum.org or on Twitter at @intlspycast. I'm your host, Andrew Hammond, and my podcast content partner is Erin Dietrich. The rest of the team involved in the show is Mike Mincy, Memphis Vaughan III, Emily Coletta, Afua Anokwa, Elliot Peltzman, Trey Hester, and Jen Ivan. This show is brought to you from the home of the world's preeminent collection of intelligence and espionage-related artifacts, the International Spy Museum.